of the British royal family and their crimes against humanity during a long period of time, the Western media tries to show the world that the Queen's death has been a great loss for the British and the people in Commonwealth countries. On the other hand, the West tries to censor the negative reactions to the Queen's death, either in the press or in the social media pages. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported the BBC has disabled comments under a tweet celebrating Queen Elizabeth II's long-standing relationship with Africa after the post drew public outrage, with people calling the tribute a rebranding of colonialism. The post in question was published on Twitter by the BBC's African arm recently in the wake of the long-serving monarch's death and featured a 4.5-minute video celebrating Queen Elizabeth's relations with Africa and its leaders throughout her 7-year reign. However, a number of people took issue with the post, stating that the BBC was trying to rebrand colonialism by sugarcoating Britain's rule over Africa, which continued into the late 20th century. According to RT, in 1980, Zimbabwe became the last African nation to gain independence from the UK. Many went on to provide examples of how African freedom fighters suffered at the hands of their British oppressors throughout the years, with some users citing Kenya's Mau Mau anti-colonial uprising, which resulted in 1.5 million Kenyans being kept in British concentration camps and heavily patrolled villages amid widespread starvation and torture. She became queen while on tour in Kenya. Africans were segregated, enslaved, tortured, and killed on their own hands, one Twitter user wrote, adding, "This is what the BBC consider a long-term relationship. We never had a relationship with Elizabeth. It was imperialism and colonialism, meaning it was forced into us. Colonial relationship," another pointed out in Twitter. As the negative outpour continued, BBC Africa's social media team banned any new comments and now only allows those tagged by the channel itself to contribute to the thread. Also, according to Intercept, Twitter has recently deleted a Carnegie Mellon University professor's tweet condemning Queen Elizabeth II. The removal of the post illustrates how criticisms of powerful people, however distasteful, can be disappeared from social media sites for murky reasons. Eleven Duke, an assistant professor at Stanford Law School and a scholar of content moderation policies, told Intercept, "It does highlight the power imbalances that can often exist in the way these platforms treat powerful figures. Often people in power get allowances because it's in the public interest, but people don't for criticizing them, even though that's often clearly in the public interest too." A According to the Common Dreams website, negative reaction to the Queen's passing was not limited to the Global South. Despite the historic reconciliation between Ireland and Britain this century, there were celebrations in Dublin as a crowd singing Lizzie's in a Box at a Celtic FC football match at Test and among the Irish diaspora. I am Irish, tweeted MSNBC contributor Kathleen Burns, saying, "Hating the Queen is a family matter." Welsh leftists got in one the action too. The Welsh Underground Network tweeted in a litany of reasons why we will not mourn. We will not mourn for royals who oversaw the protection of known child molesters in the family, the group said. The separatists added, we will not mourn for royals who oversaw the active destruction of the Welsh language and the Welsh culture.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanted whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the mourning ceremony of Imam Hussein during such occasion and the Arba'een pilgrimage and this season of pilgrimage, in fact, somebody asked the question, and I would like you to share your response and according to Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwas, of course. Somebody asked that he's a college student, all right, and he says that I am just recently enrolled in the final term of my undergraduate school. I would really like to travel to Karbala for the occasion of Arba'een, but I am certain that if I mention this trip, to Karbala, to Iraq, to my father, he will not, give me permission because the roads are really crowded and for other obvious reasons, in fact, his concerns, and for a number of other reasons, of course. Is it permissible that I embark on the trip without informing my parents and let them know only when I'm well or already on the way?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If traveling without your parents' knowledge will cause them to be distressed or put them under, unnecessary distress, it is not permissible. Because basically it's not permissible to do anything that causes, that hurts your parents or that keeps them anxious or, cause them to worry about you. Of course, your father forbids, for example, if your father or mother forbids you from traveling for Arba'een out of love and concern, that's very important. That the main point that we need to take into account is if they forbid you out of love and concern, you must obey. Because if you disobey your parents,
right,
they are going to feel definitely hurt. They will be they will not be at ease leaving you to go to Iraq or to Iraq because of for whatever reasons, because they don't feel secure or because it's not safe there, or maybe because of that pressure, the crowd that is there, and because of the hot weather, they are going to get worried about you. So if they forbid you from traveling because of their own love and concern for you, you must obey them and must not do anything that hurts them or keeps them in distress.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Can a person who's in debt to his relatives, friends and, relatives that participate in the Arba'een pilgrimage, because we know that lots of people are in debt,
Sure.
Either to the banks or to their friends, to institutions or individuals. Is it permissible for those people, to participate in the Arbaeen pilgrimage? We all know that, there are some costs involved, right, in such, a ceremony or pilgrimage. So do they have to settle their debts first and then embark on this trip or pilgrimage, during this season, or no? They can go and travel and then come back and settle the receipt.
Well, if the time agreed upon for the repayment of debt has not arrived, if the time has not arrived,
right,
or if the creditor allows an extension in the repayment period, it is obviously permissible for the debtor, for you who has taken a loan or borrowed money from someone, to participate in the Arbaeen, in the Arbaeen, because the time is extended, you're not under pressure, and the time of repayment of the debt is not due, so you can participate in the Arbaeen pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
But if the repayment date has arrived and the creditor demands the repayment of his debt, then, of course, repayment of the debt takes precedence over going to the pilgrimage, because repaying your loan or paying off your debt is obligatory.
Obligatory, but the pilgrimage,
it is urgent, and you must pay it immediately as and when the creditor asks you or demands the repayment of the debt, and you cannot, let's say, bypass or somehow evade the repayment.
I see.
And of course, there are narrations, riwayat, and also reports which quite succinctly and clearly indicate that the repayment of the debt is more important. Even if when you are praying and the creditor comes at your door,
yes,
and if he is in a hurry, you must break your prayer according to the fatwa of the religious scholars.
Right.
So it's so important
and urgent
that one undertakes the trip without owing someone. And if he owes someone some money, he should go to his door and ask him to allow him to repay his loan at a time when he is able to repay it.
I see. Thank you very much.
And of course, it is important to know that people who do not pay their loans or debt and embarks on such a journey,
right,
the journey is considered to be a journey of sin. It is a sinful journey.
Right.
And of course, in a sinful journey, a person has to offer full prayers.
Right.
Full prayers.
Yes.
Because it's always the case with...
Yes.
With
I will ask you this question later about the prayer, because we have a couple of questions related to that some people asked us.
And but maybe if you can allow me to just conclude it, you see, he has to offer the four rakats in full, and he cannot shorten his prayers because it's a journey of sin, and it's always the case with a sinful journey, and that's the main point that one has to remember. And of course, we do see in my own neighborhood, I myself see a lot of people who just leave their town and their city for Karbala. I do know very well that these people have a lot to repay in terms of the debt that they have, but they don't care about it. That's not good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a very late break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Stars, your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing. Far and near, whenever I get there.
to me. Desire, desire, drink some water. Desire, desire, drink, desire, desire.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohan Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker here. Well, we are talking about, the Arbaeen season and Arbaeen pilgrimage or the walk of the Arbaeen. And, let me ask you this question. Sheikh Javed, is it permissible, in fact, to take a loan or to take some money from your friends and embark on this journey, the Arbaeen walk?
There's no objection to someone taking money from his friend,
mm-hmm.
or borrowing money from a bank in order to embark on a journey of this kind,
mm-hmm.
Let's say that he is going to be able to repay his loan, and there's no objection to him because he sees and he has a job, he has a source of income, and he will be able to repay his loan, and therefore there's no objection to him going on such a journey,
mm-hmm.
and of course paying his debt at a time when it is convenient or when it is possible for him.
I see. And if somebody does not have a good reputation, for example, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the debtor. What happens to the creditor? Can the creditor, in fact, withhold his money and not give her or him a loan, in fact, to take on this journey?
Giving a loan is not necessary for a person, When you know that the person does not have a good reputation and he's not in the habit of paying his loan on time, so one can choose not to give.
Right.
Okay? Because he will not have to, have to bear the headache and ask him and demand the repayment
right.
of his debt, because he will have to, maybe probably sometimes he might even humiliate himself.
Sure.
By going to him and asking him,
mm-hmm.
and asking is not good.
Yes,
it's
sure.
always important for a person who is, for a debtor, to repay his loan before
right.
the creditor comes to his door and asks him, because that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Morally speaking, that's
yes.
not good.
Okay, and appropriate. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein plan to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Oh, You're listening to Husseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. لبيك يا حسين.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. Peace and salutations be upon you, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I send you my condolences. We talked about incorporating Ziyarat Ashura in our lives, our day-to-day lives. We said that first, a person needs to realize that the core of Ashura is bala, is a test and tribulation that Allah has placed for Imam Hussein. And that he even wanted Imam Hussein to come to Karbala with his family members, with his children, so that he could see them become captives to complete his test and to see what Imam Hussein would do. Alhamdulillah, with his patience, Imam Hussein amazed the angels. The second position we talked about was the position of grieving for Imam Hussein, the position of sorrow. You cannot expect to benefit from Ashura while you're very happy and very joyful during this time period. When you have huzn, when you have grief, when you wear black and you basically you're showing and displaying your grief for Imam Hussein, then you will have, inshallah, the mercy and the bounties that a musab, a person that affliction and calamity happen upon them, will receive. Third, we talked about the maqam of silm and the maqam of lan and harb, meaning that we approach Imam Hussein, we come to his tent, we take away all our bad actions, all our bad habits, and we do whatever Imam Hussein and his companions did. What did they do in the night of Ashura? They were praying and worshipping towards God. Therefore, we leave everything else from our hearts besides the worship of God. Once this is done, our actions are full of fulfilling God's commands. Our hearts are full of God's remembrance. We reach, as we do the dua in Ziyarat Ashura, that Allah gives us al-maqam al-mahmud, the praiseworthy station, the station of the Holy Prophet, the position of Imam Hussein. And it is then that we begin to truly enjoy life. And this is the effect of spirituality, this al-maqam al-mahmud. Brothers and sisters, we talked about living a good life, living a very happy life, having sa'adat, having felicity. We talked about managing our pains. We talked about being able to, from Ashura, manage our pains and, inshallah, maximize our joys, our spiritual joys. This is happiness. This is the definition of happiness. With spirituality comes great joy, we talked about. And this is the other side of ubudiyat. The effect of ubudiyat, the effect of worshipping God and following Imam Hussein, following the Prophet of Islam and following Imam Hussein, we learn that it also has effects. And when you think, when you want to have ultimate joy, whenever you think that God gives you trials and tribulations because you are His servant and He is testing you, you lean into your difficulties. You say, Allah has tested me, therefore let me pass this test. Then when Allah gives you pleasures, when Allah gives you a good life, you are worshipping Him, you are an abd of Him, you are a slave of Him, and you begin to fulfill things, your entire life becomes full of joy and full of nur and light because you are now His abd. Your entire life becomes, what does Allah, how is Allah pleased? What does He want from me? What is His command? What does He not want from me? What does He want me to stay away from? And this brings for you great joy that I am a slave of God. I am happy that I'm following His commands. This is why I have been created, to do taslim. Islam is the religion of submission. I am submitting to God. Therefore, I have intense joy, intense ladha that I am His abd. Once a person becomes an abd of Allah, it says you start to become like God. You become godly. Some of the divine powers reach you, as some of the traditions have. أَطِعْنِي فِي مَا أَمَرْتُكَ أَجْعَلُكَ تَقُولُ لَشَيْءٍ كُنْ فَيَكُونَ. Follow me, Allah says in this tradition, in what I have commanded you, and you will become like me. When you say, be, it is. Or in other traditions, Allah says in these traditions, Abdi ati'ni aj'aluka mathali or mithli. Follow me and obey me and I will make you like me. Meaning that some of those divine powers that God has, you will be given. This is the other side of ubudiyat. This is the other side of maqam al-mahmud. That we talk about, you do things for a purpose. You do it for to be a servant of Allah. But know that when you're a slave of Allah, it's not like being a servant of a human or a servant of somebody else. When you became a servant of Allah, you become very powerful. And you get the divine powers of Allah. And you begin to enjoy life truly through bala, through lizzat, through calamity, through joy. All of it doesn't matter for you because you're a slave of God and you're just following and submitting to Him. And you're very happy because you're fulfilling the entire purpose of why you're created.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while innocent children die. Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
Realizing and understanding the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam through nur and light. This is something that is very possible to do and is something that has been done in history. We have in one of our traditions a group of people from Yemen, a group of worshippers, good people, they came to the Prophet inquiring about his successor. So the Prophet gave him a verse of the Quran, and they kept asking, then who is this? Who is this Hablullah? You attach yourselves to the rope of God. And then they kept asking, and finally he says, basically go out in the lines of Salat, in congregation Salat, and you will find him yourself. See who your heart inclines towards. So they began to walk, this group of Yemeni worshippers. They began to walk and walk, and then they saw one person that they were sure that was their successor, the successor of the Holy Prophet. So they come back to him, and he says, is it him? And then the Prophet says, yes, you know, he affirms the fact that it is Ali ibn Abi Talib, it is Imam Ali. And he asks him, how did you know? And the Yemenis in this hadith, they say that in this tradition, they began crying and saying, oh, Messenger of God, we looked at the people, but our hearts did not incline to any of them. When we saw this man, our hearts trembled, and then our souls felt assured. Our eyes shed tears and chests became pleased, as if he was our father and we were his children. So these worshippers, they understood who the successor, who deserved imamat after the Holy Prophet. Who was the imam after the Holy Prophet, the guide, the leader, the guardian? And why? Through ma'rifat nuraniyah. That is how they did this. And then it says that the Prophet of Islam later on talked about how these people would follow and predicted that they would follow Imam Ali, and this was true. They continued and were loyal to Imam Ali, and many of them fought with him, alongside Imam Ali against in the Battle of Safin, in the Battle of Jamal. They participated and were martyred in such battles. So this is a hadith that shows us that you have the ability to see and witness Nur and light of Imamat through your hearts. And when we reach this Maqam al-Mahmud, inshallah, that we see, that we said in Ziyarat Ashura, we connect to the Imams with this Nur and light, and we start, inshallah, becoming part of them and like them, inshallah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane also crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country. And the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when ultimately bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost. And we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
The The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the US invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the US Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped US's foreign policy. The US also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the US to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the US claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The US war on terror goes beyond the US failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the US and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The US is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The war on, so-called war on terror, was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq. There was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year, with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed, not only their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy. And this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching the publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media, it's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Moscow's warnings against the West for its punitive measures against the Kremlin continue to get tough. President Putin has now warned that Western sanctions against his country are hurting the entire world. Putin described the sanctions as short-sighted, saying the West has undermined the global economy with its aggressive attempts to impose its dominance on the world.
The United States has been pressing sanctions against Russia, individuals, private businesses, and state-owned enterprises. The European countries, most of which belong to the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, have gone along with this and have imposed their own sanctions. They're trying to cut back on the importation of Russian gas, because that provides revenue for the Russian government. But they seem to have suddenly remembered that they import 30% of their gas from Russia.
Putin also said the West has been reluctant to recognize that, quote, irreversible and tectonic shifts have occurred in international relations. According to Putin, these shifts in international relations have led to the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a magnet for human resources, capital, and production capacities. The Russian president further said that Moscow found more opportunities in the markets in the Middle East after the West imposed sanctions on Russia. Putin also attributed the unfolding global economic crisis to Western elites who, quote, would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes. He further said the U.S. and its Western allies have tried to isolate Russia, but, according to Putin, it's impossible to isolate Moscow from the global economic and political landscape.
The problem for the United States ruling class at this point is that the world is becoming increasingly multipolar. It's no longer a situation where the United States can call the shots every area politically, economically, and even militarily. China is the second, the world's second largest economy, and is that economy is advancing more rapidly than that of the United States. And the United States views this as a tremendous threat because it's an economic competitor. The United States has been involved in wars throughout its history, but certainly intensely ever since World War II.
The crisis between the West and Russia has triggered unprecedented shifts in international alliances. After the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine, the US and its European allies tried to put Russia into a corner by imposing a raft of sanctions against Moscow. They put Russia's oil and gas industries, as well as its banking and insurance sectors, under heavy sanction. But the sanctions now appear to have backfired against Europe. Following the tensions, oil and gas prices surged to unprecedented levels. The high prices were beneficial to Russia, bringing huge profits to its oil and gas sector. Furthermore, Russia has forged closer ties with China, India, and Iran.
So, and meanwhile, Russia is now selling more oil to China and India at reduced cost, but they're selling it. So, it looks like the sanctions are not going to hurt Russia nearly to the extent that the West hoped it would, and they're having repercussions on the standard of living of Europeans and North Americans, which only goes to show how integrated we are into a global economy. The sanctions are not producing the effect that the West wanted to. It's not bringing Russia to its knees, and it is also having deleterious effects on their own economies and their own peoples. So I think in that sense, President Putin was correct in his analysis.
Furthermore, the crisis put European countries into uncharted territory. Gas prices are rising dramatically in Europe following Russia's decision to stop gas exports to Europe. Moscow has cited Western sanctions as the reason for its decision and says it will not resume gas flow until Western sanctions are lifted. The energy crunch is now hurting European countries. There are now warnings of a harsh winter in Europe. There are already protests in several European countries against high costs of living and soaring prices. High electricity prices are hurting ordinary citizens in Europe as well as major businesses. Germany, which is considered Europe's biggest economy, is now on the brink of recession. Experts now warn that an economic downturn in Germany is unavoidable. And the recession in Germany will surely negatively affect the economy of the entire European Union.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله everyone. This is Arab English Radio.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This is Bita at your service.
Very happy to meet you here, Bita.
A nice pleasure.
Okay, so, this is Youth Station. We're having another episode.
Yeah, it is IRIB English Radio, and
yes,
we are at your service. It's a big pleasure. We're going to have a nice discussion together.
Before we forget the main thing, well, this is Asma. Hope you do not forget my name.
Yeah, my sister Asma. So today we're going to have a hot topic, I think, because we're going to talk about mind and brain conflict, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And between this conflict between heart and, you know, for example,
the
there are some
times
in your life that, for example, your mind can see something,
mm-hmm.
but your heart isn't, for example,
recognize
that thing, you know. And first of all, I want to start with a point. Most of the time, people think that there is an opposition between mm-hmm. these two. I mean, they think like, okay, for example, if something
So we're
is,
going through a scientific discussion.
Yeah, exactly. Not that much scientific. I think psychologic more than
yes.
scientific. And they think like, okay, we're going to talk about